I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. It's time we start the TechNet, which happens every Sunday night from 8 p.m. to 12 p.m. usually, 4 hours. And this will be TechNet number 1604 of the series that began 33 and a half years ago, 1982. So it's a very long-running TechNet. But to last that long, under essentially one leadership, and people think that it must be supplying a service that somebody cares about. The main purpose of the TechNet is education. Curious radio amateurs come together and teach each other a little bit more about how all this mysterious wireless equipment really works. Let me drop.
Referring to people by their name.
is, followed by the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment for the net. So we're going to take check-ins right now. K2RIW listening.
GSM, Rich, and yes.
Okay, we've got Rich, GXM. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name. And the word yes, that you've got a question or a comment.
AD2KIQ, my name is Brian, and yes.
Okay, is that Kilo Delta 2, Kilo India Quebec? Is that what you said, Brian? K2RIW?
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay, we apparently got Brian right. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name, just like those two guys did. K2RIW listening. One last call. Anyone with a question or comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay. Was there somebody?
W2SAW, Bill, yes.
Okay, SAW, we got you, Bill. And one last call. Anyone with a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters and your name. And the word yes, right now. We got three guys, more than enough to get started. Rich, you're number one on the runway. What would you like to talk about tonight? How are those electrons treating you? From the V2 Golf X-ray mic, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick, and happy Memorial Day to all. I just purchased the Heathkit DX60B from eBay. I haven't plugged it in. I also have a Variac, and I am heeding the warnings. Use a Variac to power up the Heathkit DX60B for the first time. Might start with 60 volts, then slowly raise the power. My question is, should I unhook or should I unsolder the power supply from the rest of the transmitter? And what would be good intervals in both voltage steps up to the final and minutes or hours? WBGXM.
A number of people have done it that way, Bill. The only component in there that requires this wake-up gentle procedure are the electrolytic capacitors. Aluminum electrolytic capacitors do have a nasty characteristic. If they've been sitting on the shelf for a long period of time and not used, they become partially depolarized, partially leaky, and bringing up the voltage on them slowly is a good way to go. Another thing that people do, just to be sure that they're not drawing too much current, is they hook up the rig to power it in the standby mode by putting it in series with, say, a 100-watt light bulb. If something really goes bad and the rig becomes a dead short circuit, the light bulb simply lights up. It becomes a current limiter. And so you're never going to get any smoke and flames, if you know what I mean, by using the light bulb technique. The Variac technique of slowly sneaking up on it is another. And how long does it take to slowly increase those voltages to reform those capacitors? Darn good question. I've heard, I've heard stories of people doing that over a period of 1 hour or a period of a day and a half, so to speak. And what's the right period of time there, I'm not sure. If you want to be double darn sure, you look at those electrolytic capacitors. And if they're more than 10 years old, you just simply replace them because they're going to be drying out and doing some not so nice things. It's a usual complaint, particularly with high voltage capacitors where they're used in series parallel combinations with voltage doubler type power supplies. I'm going to turn it over to the net to see if other people have heard of techniques for how to reform those capacitors. In other words, bolted slowly with the Variac? How slowly have they done it? Over what period of time? How much success? And were they able to bring those capacitors back to life? If you just simply take capacitors that have been sitting on the shelf for a couple of years and hit them with high voltage immediately, you could be getting a partial short circuit because it takes a while for them to be reformed. That's part of what's going on here. So anyone who's actually done this or talked to someone who has done it, heard stories about it, as to what they did and how successful it was, give me a call. That is right now. K2RIW in the tech man.
WH4YY.
KC to Kirkwood.
I heard Joe, W2RYY. I heard Eric, KE2EJ. I think it was the third person in there. Who was the third person?
KC2WGB.
Never heard of them. Okay. We're going to go to Joe, Eric, and John in that order. W2RYY. How often have you done that, Joe? What did you do and how successful was it? W2RYY. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, first of all, I believe what you said. If the power supply has capacitors in it over 10 years old, especially something from a very early vintage like 1960s, 1970s equipment, pretty much you can be guaranteed those capacitors are going to short once you put some sort of high voltage on them. A good telltale thing you can look at visually is to see if the capacitor at the bottom of them near the tabs, if they have any kind of like openings into the material itself, because that's usually a good sign that something's gotten in there like moisture, and it almost guarantees if you put voltage, any kind of voltage, even half its normal DC voltage, they can all of a sudden get to a certain point and short. And they'll take out like diodes, and bridge rectifier, things like that, and of course your fuses first. I've rebuilt quite a few power supplies with the type of repeater equipment I've worked on using my network from years ago, which is used capacitors as high as 800 volts, and almost every single one I've had to rework the capacitors because of the AC equipment, so that's a good sign, good thing you can check. Simple thing to do is if you have a schematic of the equipment, you can disconnect your load from the output of the power supply by the major load point. Maybe go to a switching relay or something like that, disconnect it, and just simply measure the DC or the resistance of the power supply itself to chassis. That might be a good indication if the capacitors look like they may be slightly leaky or something like that, because generally the stuff is going to be, several hundred thousand ohms, depending if you have bleeders across some of the capacitors now, but you see very, very, very high resistance on the capacitors to ground. If you don't, probably the best thing to do is change them just to be on the safe side. They don't cost that much, and you'd be buying yourself a lot less power by doing it that way. Back to you.
Joe, what about the idea of putting a 100-watt light bulb in series with the power supply and the
repeater? Time out.
As you can hear, I didn't wait for the four beeps. What about the 100-watt light bulb in series with the 110-volt line and the power supply, so that if in the worst case it becomes a short circuit, the light bulb simply lights? Have you used that technique, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, I have. Depending on the type of light bulb you're using, the exact resistance of the light bulb is, may limit the power supply from starting to develop, enough high voltage. Bringing up with Variac is another good idea with a light bulb in series with Variac going to your power supply. But simple things like I suggest using either a digital VOM or a regular analog type of VOM like a Simpson 260 is a very good way of starting point to see which way you're going to be going. Because you might find that you have to replace a lot of caps before you even try to power thing up. You might find stuff is maybe 10, 20,000 ohms resistance on some of your high voltage circuits to ground. That's more than enough to take out your bridge, your rectifier diodes.
Yeah, the bridge rectifier diodes, about the only way you lose those is because the capacitors act like such a short circuit, and you've got a very low impedance source of power, like LiPa or Loco or Con Ed, and therefore it's a huge amount of current to go through those diodes and the short circuit capacitors, and you wipe out the diodes. It's your current limiting by way of a 110-volt light bulb, for instance, say 100-watt light bulb, and the current that can flow through that light bulb into your power supply, into those rectifying diodes, I think will not wipe them out. I think you're protecting them. Another question would be, should you use a variac as well as a 110-volt light bulb? Because a real Stucci variac, even though it's set at 60 volts, because you're slowly sneaking up on the voltage, if the power supply becomes a dead short, then a huge amount of current can flow. So the light bulb is a very safe way, I believe. Let's see what Eric has done along these lines. KE2EJ, how have you woken up old-fashioned power supplies? K2RIW in the TechNet, you've got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ, well, 100-watt light bulbs, a little on the small side stuff. I tend to like to use 150-watt light bulb or 200-watt light bulb. That comes from the days of when I was fixing people's hi-fi audio amplifiers and, transistor outputs and sensors and stuff like that. But why is my fuse blown? Took a light bulb into it and you can actually find it. Usually it's shorted out for transistors or something like that. But, let me get to the capacitor issue. Don't forget that I use broadcast dealer. You might make money, so I have to make sure I'm here. And one of my favorite transistors uses 30,000 microfarad capacitors at 50 volts. Not high volts, it's your stuff, but it's only got big. The one that runs at 30,000 volts and has a half a parrot on it. Oh, it's big. They can do really nasty things, but one of the things that I want to point out with this kind of gear is that it's all step size stuff. So they don't allow the full current to flow through. But, it's big resistance, current limited, let it build up slowly. But one of the things I do with some old caps is I try to think of that as a scientific approach to it. Is I usually read it with an ESR meter first. If it's something ridiculous, you know you're going to throw it out because the electrolyte's not there. And when you start putting juice into it, all you're going to do is make a lot of heat. And you do it all at once, you make either get some really good outgassing and explosions, or you get nice smoldering, snowing fires. But and I have taken stuff that's been on the shelf for like 10 or 12 years and over a long period of time, slowly brought them up. The ESRs are good. You know you're going to be able to bring it back to life, but you got to do it really slowly and carefully. You might want to use just a simple diode and a variac and go at it that way and put the light bulb in the end just in case. Keep your IW cases,
yeah. Yeah, when it comes to, let me drop it. When it comes to your great big broadcast transmitters, particularly the really high voltage ones, I am guessing those were oil-filled capacitors. And I think under normal circumstances, if they were not manufactured correctly, they last forever. I don't think they age. But when it comes to aluminum-type electrolytic capacitors, yes, they've got some nasty characteristics of drying out, depolarizing, need a wake-up procedure, and so on. When you did slowly increase the voltage to bring them back to life, did you do it over a period of hours or days, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Certain caps with low working voltages is usually, I think it was, we raise it like 10 volts every hour or something like that and go for 2 or 3 days. The really big caps that have really nasty voltages, we did it slowly, a little bit at a time over a period of a week. And you can actually measure the difference as you go through the process. You can discharge them nicely through a device and see how fast they charge. Just do a simple test with an audio oscillator and measure the current constant. And as the capacitors become more healthy, you see that time period gets a lot longer.
One of the tools you used, Eric, is an ESR meter, equivalent series resistance. And I think the way they usually work is they either do or don't put a DC voltage on the capacitor. But they're putting an AC voltage and measuring the current drain in I equals CDVDT. Yeah. By way of a formula like that, you know what current should be drawn if the equivalent series resistance the capacitor is the right number or lower than that number. The ESON meter that you used, what brand name, how many dollars? It sure would be nice if our digital multimeters that we could buy contained an ESR function. And maybe it does if you buy the right brand. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. First of all, my ESR meters are homemade. I think I made them 15 or 20 years ago, whatever long it's been. It's really easy to do, it's not hard. You know, there's even a nice little YouTube video on how to make one by W2HW. You can copy it, it's real simple. And it's quite an amazing tool. Not that hard, a few parts in a meter. And you can actually calibrate it accurately if you choose to do that. It's a very useful tool. You can buy them. There's Chinese ones now for like $20 or something like that.
WHOR.com on ESR meter. I can suggest one that the guy can use. It's more than $20, but they work very well because YouTube them bad.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Eric and Joe in that order. Joe, you said that YouTube video on how to homebrew one with W2AEW is what it sounds like. Whiskey 2 Alpha Echo Whiskey. If he Googles that word and ESR, will he come up with the video? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, I guarantee you will. I don't know which video number. He's got like 150 videos on there, various different subjects. I mean, he's actually a salesperson for the Nick Monitor, so he's got a lot of good stuff, and he does an excellent job of presentation. Makes it simple for you to really understand what's going on.
Very good, Eric, and thank you. Joe's got some further comments on ESR meters. I bet you've homebrewed one, or, oh no, you know of one that can be purchased without a zillion dollars. The K2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I've used one or two different radio shops that work for it. It actually works very nice. It's made by B&K. It's a BK, I believe the model is a BK881. They range in price from about 180 to about 210, for what I've seen looking for them on the internet. Perhaps maybe a little cheaper, but somewhere in that price range. But it can test from 0.47 microfarad up to 2200, and it gives you a direct readout on the not display, but the way it's set up. If the cap falls within the range or falling out of the range, so you have an immediate visual display if the cap is like a little out of its range or not. Back to you.
I've never seen one like that.
Oh. And Joe, I think you said it's $210 for the BMK. What was that model number? BMK 801 is what I think you said. Now, I'm putting myself in Rich's shoes, GXM shoes. You can go out and buy a meter in theory for $210, or just to test these particular capacitors. Or because he doesn't need one of these things very often. Sure, it'd be nice if a major club like Limock owned one of those and could simply loan it out to the members. But if I was in Rich's shoes, I would say, gee, just simply replacing every one of those capacitors is not going to cost me $210. So just bite the bullet and completely replace the capacitors.
I got a comment about that.
Go ahead, Eric.
Be a really good one. It's all surface mount stuff, but you'll like this. There's a machine that's going back 10 years or 15 years, however it is, because we don't use tape in video anymore. There was a machine called a D3 machine, which is basically a digital video tape recorder. And essentially, every 3 years, on the DMOD board and the servo board, it sort of became mandatory that you replace every single capacitor on that board because they would just simply go bad. They just couldn't tolerate the electrolytes and just disappear from them. That's one of the problems with this stuff. They still have that issue. Although the sealed, epoxy sealed electrolytes are cool, but they have a tendency to explode. Oh, speaking of which, now, This is when the World Trade Center was still up. I'm looking at a drop because it's a little bit of a delay. A couple of broadcasters in the same transmitter. You know, people had spare parts on their show. They were taking them out. They had problems with power supply. Power supply has got a matrix bank, literally. It's 5 by 6 rows of, I think they were 75,000 microfarad capacitors at 80 volts. Anyway, my friend was checking out their caps, and I was testing for them. You know, I said, this one's got a series equivalent to this one. So it looks like one of them looked like a dead short, and the other one looked like it's way over 30 volts. He said, nah, okay. So he put them in. And it didn't take long for both of them to be close. Keep your eye on WK2 again.
The capacitors that exploded, Eric, I'm going to ask you what kind they were. There's a whole lot of pieces of very quality pieces of test equipment. Hewlett-Packard spectrum analyzers, Hewlett-Packard vector voltmeters,
They were CDEs.
CDEs, okay. A good brand name under normal circumstances. And let's see now, vector voltmeter, that's not what I'm looking for. Digital, you know what I mean. The machine that everybody's using these days for making Smith chart measurements. I can't think of a three-letter abbreviation. John, what's that three-letter abbreviation?
The vector network analyzers?
That's it, VNA. All right, so there's a lot of pieces of quality test equipment that have got a zillion of these tantalum capacitors, roughly 1, 2, 3 microfarads at 35 volts. Tiny little thing. And after 10, 15, 20 years, roughly 10% of them become a short circuit for mysterious reasons. Let me drop. And when they do, they can give you a lot of grief. As I said, they just simply become a short circuit. So there's many a conservative person that gets a hold of one of these quality pieces of test equipment at 15 or so years old, 20 years old, and just simply replaces every one of those 1, 2, 3 microfarad, 35 volt tantalum capacitors, tiny little things, axial leads on them. Because they know they're going to be breaking down in the future. So, capacitors can be troublesome. Now, John, what kind of aging procedure have you used to wake up your capacitors? Or do you just take the brute force approach and simply replace all of the aluminum electrolytic high voltage capacitors that are in the power supplies of the pieces of the test equipment that you acquire? And you're one of those lucky guys that have acquired lots of pieces of test equipment. If you've got any doubt in your mind, go to John's QRZ.com site, QRZ.com, and dial in KC2WGB, and look at those page after page of pieces of test equipment that's in his dual laboratory, that's in his two-sided garage. Each side of the garage is half of that laboratory. You're going to see a zillion pieces of test equipment. So when it comes to waking up capacitors and older pieces of equipment, sounds to me like you've been there and done that, John. KC2WGB, KQLIW in the thick man.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Eric, everyone on the net. Yes, I've done it a lot. I've gone through old equipment and ran into this problem many times. The reason the Variac, when it's used, you must have a light bulb in it, especially for the people who are going to try to solve some of the problems on newer equipment, is some of the equipment will not turn on at half voltage. So as you raise that Variac and you get it up to where it's going to turn on, it may be too late. That's where that bulb will protect it. All the other stuff they mentioned, perfect, excellent method of doing it, but that light bulb is critical, especially if you're using something, you know, some of these supplies are quite heavily in current. They're operated at a maximum range, so you must be careful. Another thing, too, if you have a schematic, and like Joe said, isolate the power supply, and actually take a power supply and place a voltage, start, like Eric said, maybe 10 volts, and then work up to your voltage in 10 or 15 volt increments. That's a perfect way of doing it, and then you don't have to worry about it. But yes, and if they're over 10 years old, which you can usually tell by the dates, even Mallory's and the Cornell Dubilier's, the good stuff, that there's a problem after 10 years. So that's about it from me. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, Cornell Dubilier makes except for one particular case. The CDR ham-end type rotators, AR-22 rotators. Lots and lots of hams have run into those, where, particularly in the wintertime.
Pinchy caps, they're nasty.
Yes, particularly in the wintertime, they think that the grease has gone solid and the rotator has lost turning torque. In reality, that 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor in there, almost every one of those with a paper outer coating wax on the end, they dry out, and 120 microfarads goes down to 5 microfarads real fast. And when it does, the turning torque, which might have been a whole lot of foot-pounds, becomes a couple of milli-ounce inches, if you know what I mean, and they can't turn anymore. So you think, because it happens on a cold day, you've got frozen grease, and those capacitors, what I've done is to replace them with motor start capacitors that are known to be a lot higher in quality. I remember going to Harrison Electronics in Farmingdale and buying a brand new capacitor off the shelf to substitute for the normal capacitor that's in the control box for a AR-22. Off the shelf, they were already dried out, so it doesn't even require usage. Let me drop. And you also got another peculiar characteristic. You command the rotator to go clockwise or counterclockwise, and nothing happens. You leave it in the clockwise control command mode for a couple of minutes, and sometimes the capacitor wakes up and the rotator starts moving. The capacitor somehow comes back to life a little bit. So failing tantalum capacitors, becoming very low in microfarads and so on, really something. I think you want to say a few more words on this one, Eric. KQEJ, KQRIW.
Yeah, you left me a voicemail earlier, and I just wanted to answer your query. If you can remember the first 3 digits, which I'm sure you can, the next digit is .4. That should help you. That's where, as far as the caps go, AC motor caps, they take a beating. And, you'd be surprised how long they don't last. I have used some really high quality ones, like on the boat lift out in Florida. And they last a while, but depending upon the usage, how often you bang them, they tend to change your life. K2RW, K2J.
Okay, I thank you for that information, Eric. That could be a good backup if need be. But since you're at the command center, I'm pretty sure it's not going to be required. One of the crazy capacitor stories. One of the things that we used to have a lot of fun with when I was at Pratt Institute, and you're in the laboratory, and the laboratory has off to one side a supply room. And so in order to do a particular experiment, you're supposed to collect this many resistors of that value and this many capacitors and so on in order to do the lab experiment. And we used to have some fun by sending somebody over to the supply guy and say, give us a 35-volt 1-farad capacitor. And the guy, of course, would say, what the hell are you guys talking about? In those days, the biggest capacitor you could get a hold of was 500 microfarads. 1 farad would be, let me think, 1,000 microfarads? No, 1,000,000 microfarads. Nothing that big existed in those days. Okay. A good buddy of mine just recently mailed me a pair of capacitors that are 5 farads each. A 5-farad capacitor today is about 1.5 inches long, about 3/8 of an inch in diameter, with axial leads coming out of it. It's only good to 2.7 volts. Let me drop. So 2.7 volts, 5 farads. One of the definitions of capacitance is that if it was a 1-farad capacitor, I equals C V T, if you put 1 ampere of DC current through it, the capacitor would either charge up or discharge at the rate of 1 volt per second. 1 farad, 1 volt per second, I equals CV, it solves that equation. So you can store a lot of energy in that capacitor. 5 farads, 2.7 volts. So I did a calculation as to how many joules it'll store, 1/2 CV squared, so on. And then I said, okay, if that exact amount of volume was petroleum, oil, and if you could convert that oil into energy, what are we talking about here, energy capacity? Do the calculation and you come to the conclusion that the biggest number of microfarads you can easily buy in a small, convenient package these days. Let me drop. exact same volume of petroleum, which would be a couple of grams of petroleum, and you calculate how many BTUs comes out of either one, I could take the voltage out of the capacitor, heat up a resistor with it while I'm discharging it, or I could be burning the petroleum and creating heat. What's the ratio? The petroleum is more than 10,000 times more energy efficient, if you know what I mean. I think the number was 20,000. So the same volume of petroleum has got 20,000 times more energy than the storage capacitor of that particular one that I'm talking about. It gives you a little bit of an idea as to how difficult it is to make a purely electric automobile having a reasonable range with batteries, capacitors, or whatever on board by comparison to petroleum in the tank. You might have a couple of words you want to add to that one, Eric, because you're one of the guys for quite a few years who have used electric vehicles. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, think about the size of that capacitor. Not bad. That's a lot of storage. Put a zillion of them together, you get an awful lot of storage. Not pound for pound the same as petroleum. But there's a number of caveats that you've got to think about when dealing with that. And that is, we're talking about a car and petroleum, okay? How much pollution do we make by either method? If we're getting it from the sun, we're not putting anything back into the atmosphere. If we're getting it from the electric company, you know there's some fossil fuel being burned, converted into electricity, and that electricity is being stored. Just to give you a little sense of how big is a motor in a car? 50 kilowatts, 70 kilowatts, 80 kilowatts? I've seen them with 125 kilowatt motors. Although you have some advantages that, in terms of efficiency, if you want to break it down, the difference between carrying petroleum with you or taking some converted energy. Let me drop. You know, the maximum use of energy in a car is during acceleration. Once you get the inertia going, the amount of energy that you need to keep it going begins to drop a bit. And of course, when you stop, you're not using any energy at all. Although with the petroleum vehicles, we've got better at it. Turn the engine off now and we stop, as opposed to earlier models where we don't do that. So, and the other thing, of course, with electric vehicles is that as you come to a stop, rather than just wasting that energy, you put it back in your battery. So, and by the way, that technology is getting much better, especially as battery capacity continues to increase. I'd still like to see them through zinc air, but it's not practical. It would mean, you know, it's a chemical process where you actually, they've designed them where you replace the core or the stuff that can be replated and reprocessed because you can't charge that battery. You can discharge it, and then you have to go through a chemical process to turn it back into fresh again. And it has the most energy capacity of all the batteries that we've ever created, so. But we're getting there with different variations of lithium batteries. K2RIW is K2EJ.
Something for us to look forward to. We Imperial people, Imperial standards people, United States in particular, we rate almost all of our electric motors, all of our gasoline motors, petroleum motors, in horsepower. 746 watts. One horsepower. The rest of the world, this metric, rates engines in watts and kilowatts. 746, one horsepower. We think a good size gasoline motor for an automobile is 100 horsepower. Now that's 74.6 kilowatts. 74.6 kilowatts is what most Europeans would call a 100 horsepower engine. We rate it in cubic inches, and they rate it in cubic meters or cubic centimeters. So we're very slow to go metric. 98% of the world, so to speak, is metric, and very few countries are still using imperial things for making measurements. United States, portions of Japan, and just a couple of places in South America are really dragging their feet on that. They buy their gasoline in liters, we buy it in gallons, we rate our horsepower in engines in horsepower, they do it in kilowatts or watts.
So you use imperial gallons, which is different.
Yep. Let me drop.
about our tour rate, Dick? There's a thrill for you.
No end to all these numbers. So, I know we got pretty far rich off one side there, Rich, but you might need a fill on some of the things you've heard. One good question you asked. So we meet through GXM for any other comments or questions, K2LAW and the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Well, thank you, Joe, Eric, John, and Dick. I have a lot of stuff to think about, and I've been writing like crazy. And I appreciate all the information. Obviously, the DX60B is my first love, and I expect to treat it with loving care. I'm going to look up the ESR meter. I'm going to use that 150-200-watt light bulb with the Variac. I'm going to look at John's comments about time and his webpage. And by the way, Dick, the one use for those supercapacitors is in model railroad engines to keep them going over dirty track. Thank you, K2RIW on the TechNet, WB2GXM.
And you've got a good project there, and that DX60 is an oldie but goodie. Please come back in a future week and let us know how your experiment went. Whether it worked well, whether it didn't work well, let us know, Joe. The next person was Brian, Kilo Delta 2, Kilo India, Quebec. You got it, Brian. How are those electrons treating you? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, this is Brian, KD2KIQ. I've been listening to all of the nets for some time now. I guess about 6 months or so, not as long as I made it sound. But, listening to radio in general for the past 13 years, finally got my tech license in February of this year. So the sky's the limit, I guess, as far as test taking goes. Anyway, less so question, more of a comment on the net. I just wanted to say that it's very cool, the conversations that go on. I've learned a ton in the short time that I've been listening, hearing all the voices, the personalities, all people from all different walks of life coming and having a big friendly chat about all things tech. I guess I have a little bit of a question too. I live up in I'm up in Oldfield, up on the North Shore, and I've had some issues as far as signal and getting my signal out there, because right now my only radio is the it's an HT, a Yaesu FT-270, it's a 2 meter, 5 watt. I'm assuming, because you guys are hearing me, that that my signal's getting through. I'm using one of those Slim Jim antennas that N9TAX makes. I don't know, I was just wondering, you know, not asking for a signal report, but overall the signal quality, how it is, and as far as a recommendation around Long Island for, Radio Shack is long since defunct. I don't know if there are any sorts of radio shops around the island that I could check out in person and patronize, I guess, because my kit is still in its infancy. I'm pretty eager to expand that. KD2KIQ.
Comment, Dick. I got some information.
Rich recognized. Brian, your audio sounds beautiful. Not too much, not too little. Nice, round, good-sounding audio. Your carrier into the machine is dead full quieting. And you must have a very good path between you and Oldfield, near East Setauket, and the repeater. I didn't hear you on the input. I expected to, so I'm a little bit amazed by that. And I presume you're also coming into the western input of the machine, 146.8525, as opposed to the 975.375. And one other piece of information I was going to give to Rich that I forgot, which maybe you might want to know about also, when it comes to, he said he was writing furiously of all the information we were giving him. Let me drop. All of these words that all of those people said are being continuously recorded, and after a few days after the TechNet, you will find that recording on the website of amateurradio.tangovictor. www.amateurradio, no punctuation, amateurradio.tangovictor. Choose the right year, the right month, and the last 10 years of TechNet are all recorded. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and it's in 4-hour reels, and you can play it all back, and therefore you can listen to it as many times as you want, so you don't have to write furiously. Now, when it comes to Radio Shack, used to sell lots of things that were very handy, and they don't exist anymore. There are a good number of websites that sell electronics, and I think Rich is eventually going to bring us some of that to our attention. Let me drop it. Your handy talkie is working very well, and I presume you're running right from it directly from its rubber duck. Usually when a person your distance away from the repeater does that, as he moves it around slightly and walks around the room, so to speak, you hear fades of the RF into the repeater, which I heard none of. But when it comes to VHF, good use. Altitude is everything. No matter what kind of an adapter, no matter what kind of yucky coax cable you use, from that handy talkie to an antenna that's higher up. If you could put an antenna on the chimney of the house or on the top of a tower, it will make your signal to the repeater 20 decibels stronger. 20 decibels is a 100-to-1 ratio. Your 5 watts will sound like 500 watts by comparison when you add that altitude. To use your handy talkie from an automobile, the automobile is a partial shield. Let me drop. So any means by which you put an adapter on the handy talkie, unplug the rubber duck, put an adapter, a piece of coax cable, going to a mag mount on the roof of the car, that'll make you 10 dB louder, 10-to-1 ratio of more apparent power output. I'm a big believer in mag mount antennas, because when I drive to New York City, I can easily remove the mag mount, put it in the trunk of my car, and now I'm not advertising it. There's a radio in there, and this is the car that they should break into. And a mag mount antenna, there are lots of people who believe that a mag mount is lower in performance as opposed to an antenna that's really screwed through the sheet metal of the car. Absolutely not true. Lots of people believe that. Properly designed mag mount gives you 99% of the performance. And the nice thing about the mag mount, as I said, you can easily remove it. And my favorite way to bring the cable into the car is to bring the cable through the upper slot where the door closes. But don't bring it directly across that rubber seal. Otherwise, you'll get some dripping water inside. And now, bring the cable around the perimeter of the rubber seal around the door, and at the bottom of the door, and let the coax cable go across the rubber seal. That way, the water drains out instead of in, if you know what I mean. And then the cable goes under the rug and wherever I want it to go inside the car, to go to either the brick amplifier or the handy-talkie, for instance. So, what you do with antennas and what you do with the altitude of the antenna makes a huge difference. You've done something right. I'm amazed you sound that well at that location, Brian. Let's see what Eric's got to say. Rich has got to say as to your question on the lack of Radio Shack. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Okay, take N2EO. Yes, I don't know if Brian is looking for parts or equipment, but the reason places like Anderson Radio went out of business, the 800 numbers came along, people would go out to Anderson, Farmingdale, whatever, and they had the store, but 225 Greenwich Street went out a few years ago. They go out there, they look at equipment, but because of the high taxes in New York, they would look at it in Anderson and then buy it online or pull up and buy it tax-free from HRO and ATS or one of the other companies. Well, I want to tell Brian, if you need equipment, this guy is very good. It's a part-time business. I'm here to be said. He runs a small company. His name is Gene. His call is W2KJI, and he's got a showroom and a small store in New Jersey called KJI electronics. Hold on. Can you give his phone number? You know, I got cataracts. It's hard to see. 973-571-1930. I think I gave it right. I have a problem seeing contact list, but he ships. I've only had good luck with him. He's very knowledgeable. Sometimes he'll tell me, don't buy that, buy this. And he's always right. He's very honest. I bought from him a $500 Bearcat scanner recently and a $600 PowerStar antenna tuner shipped it to New York from New Jersey. So there was no tax. I highly recommend it.
Good information, Rich, and I thank you. As I see it, Brian, because of the lack of Radio Shack, there is a surplus store on the south shore of Long Island that sold surplus equipment. Well, there's another fairly good electronics store in, what's the name of that town? Plainview, I think it is. There's a store that sells electronic parts. There's still one left. A little hard to find because...
L&L.
Oh, what was that again?
About the feedback. L&L in South on Robin's Lane. They sold parts. There's also KRP in Farmingdale, but that's basically overstock stuff. You don't know... It's surprising that you get what you get from this. You get some really surprising stuff, some really common stuff you're not going to get. But if he's all the way out by Secaucus, I mean, there's nothing to stop him from taking the ferry to Connecticut. And going to ARS, the toys up there.
Okay, so one of the rare electronic stores still left is L&L Electronics on Robin's Lane. What town is that in, Eric?
Syosset.
Okay, on Robin's Lane in Syosset. A little bit hard to find the store. You go to the right shopping center, so to speak, with a parking lot out in front.
They're in the next row back. They used to be in front.
And they're in the next row back. In other words, you can just barely see a sign over their door. And you go through that door, and you see a great big showroom of all kinds of electronics. L&L Electronics in Syosset. So one of the few rare stores left. Other than that, mail order is gone.
Would you believe that Lionel is still alive and being annoying as ever?
Okay, so you being a trivia expert from way back, tell us what L&L Electronics, L&L stands for. Lionel is one of the names of the two guys. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, I forget the N. I think it was Neil, but that partner long since passed away. But, you know, they have their crew, and I think the kid is keeping it going. But Lionel's there every day, not every day, every couple of days, every week.
Leo and Lionel.
Yeah, I was going to guess it was going to be Leo and Lloyd. Leno and Lionel. L and L. Okay. So, we've got... There's still a store where you can directly buy electronics and see a nice showroom and touch all the stuff. It's got various kinds of kits on the walls and bubble packs. They got a lot of stuff there. A little bit more than Radio Shack in some respects. And some of it's higher quality and deeper stocked and so on. My latest antenna rotator I put on the roof of my car, on my house for my television aerial, I bought from them, for instance. Other than that, mail order by way of eBay, Amazon, AEL, and all these other places. An awful lot of the big chunks of electronics, like base station rigs, mobile rigs, you're probably going to buy by mail order. Although I'm a big believer in used equipment, so there you would be getting it from eBay. I like everything used. Almost everything I got is used because I can maintain things, and in many cases the used equipment is one third the price. For example. Yeah, and even that microscope was used. Somebody made a comment that the audio was so low, the signal was so weak, I didn't hear a single word. So any change you can make, I'm going to give it back to you. Now, we are very lucky in the United States that all of the mail order houses, internet houses we can go to, in a very short period of time, we can get just about anything we want. Picture a poor guy like Manfred von Henrich. Like all of a sudden, I can't think of his call letters. He lives in La Salina, Chile. And for him to buy electronics is a real pain. He can't even get coaxial cable. The coaxial cable he can buy in Santiago, Chile, has about 35% coverage of the braid, you know, real chintzy stuff by our standards. And he can't even order it by mail order from some other country because it takes a month of Sundays to get it through customs. And even then, you only get it if you pay a whole bunch of bribes to people in customs. So we take for granted how easy it is for us to get stuff. Now, somebody had a comment. Try once again. Give us more audio, more RF if you can, and make your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Y2JJ.
Okay, NY2JJ. Go right ahead with your comment. Start up with your name, sir.
Jason Minette. My name is John. There are Radio Shacks in Huntington and in Levittown.
Good to know. So Levittown and Huntington still has a Radio Shack.
My office said it. Thank you.
Okay, so there are a couple of them scattered around the world, around the United States, around Long Island. However, I needed a particular electrolytic capacitor that used to be a Radio Shack product. It's in their catalog. I walked into the store, I pointed to the capacitor, I gave them a Radio Shack part number, and said, sell me one of these. He says, oh, that's a catalog item. We ain't got that in the store. We have to order that for you. Only the high volume stuff is kept in the store. And electrolytic capacitors are not kept in the store. I was very disappointed by that.
So,
I'm listening to you, Eric. Go ahead.
It really all depends upon the owner of the store. In every Radio Shack store, you'll find two metal cabinets filled with drawers. On the front of them will be labeled capacitors, transistors, integrated circuits, connectors. It's all, you know, it's a pretty good mix of stuff. Some really decent value resistors, really decent value capacitors. Fairly common. 555 timers, 356 audio amplifiers, you know, pretty common stuff. And by the way, I got a good story for you about getting parts in a foreign country. When we were doing the Polish National Opera, if you want, I'll tell you that story. It's a good one.
Yeah, I've seen those metal drawers with lots of good stuff, but there's a catch. Almost everything these days is solid state. Therefore, the capacitors that are feeding the power supplies for solid state rarely need more than 10, 15, 20, 25 volts. I needed 150 volt rated capacitors.
To find those.
They didn't exist. And he said, no, we don't stock that in the store. That's in the catalog. I said, how long will it take to get in the catalog? He gave me some number of weeks. And I said, of all the other Radio Shack stores on the island, this is before they had closed. I said, does any of them have that, according to your computer records, do you have this 150 microfarad capacitor? Or was it a 150 volt, couple of microfarad capacitor? The answer was no. And none of the stores had it. So certain kinds of parts, I was repairing a tube-type television set at the time, and this high-voltage capacitor was part of the horizontal sweep circuit. And so I couldn't get that capacitor from Radio Shack without ordering it from their storeroom and waiting a couple of weeks for it to arrive. And so I had to find other ways. In fact, John supplied the capacitor for me at that particular time. Anybody has any further comments on where Brian can buy parts, kits, antennas, and so on Long Island, other than the mail order houses and Radio Shack? K2RIW listening.
It's Leo.
Sounds like Richard's got some additional equipment. And JKI is a nice guy, but and you can get it from him mail order. But to travel to New Jersey to see it in his showroom could be a little bit inconvenient for people who live on Eastern Long Island. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, so yes, unfortunately, we reality is most everything is mail ordered today.